Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Matsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Dog Works Radio in the search bar. And on the line, I hope we have our co-host calling in from Southern California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great. I dropped out for a second there, but I am back.
Well, good to have you on. What's happening down in Southern California?
Well, you know, we are relatively uneventful compared to how you are doing up there. And I know before we get into our main topic, we wanted to talk a little bit about the sockeye fire in particular, and I guess all of the fires in Alaska in general, which I know had a huge effect on you and a lot of your friends and neighbors up there in Willow.
Yes. Unless you're living under a rock, you've probably heard about the fires up here in Alaska. And, you know, we have quite a few fires up here every year. And typically they burn and they don't cause too many problems. But in particular, the fire there that is known as the Sockeye Fire started about a week and a half ago on Sunday afternoon, and it spread very quickly, and it was only about 5 miles from the center of our community of Willow, where there are literally hundreds of mushers and maybe even thousands of dogs. And within a few minutes, there was mushers moving as fast as they could to their dog yards and evacuating as soon as possible to make sure that everybody was safe, human and dogs. And we could talk about it all hour, Alex, but what do you think of it? I'm sure you followed it from the outside. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, there's a bunch of things. As you mentioned, there are wildfires in Alaska every year, every summer. Usually they are not in areas where there are a lot of people, so many of them are allowed to burn. This year, there just wasn't a lot of snow, as people following Iditarod might know. So the conditions have been very, very dry, and then it's been a little bit unusually warm, I think, for Alaska this June. And so that's a pretty bad combination for fires. And a lot of times, if you have this type of atmosphere and this type of conditions, when there is a fire, there tends to be a lot of fuel that will burn very, very quickly. We have a lot of wildfires down here in Southern California every summer as well, and so that's unfortunately something I'm pretty familiar with. Although I have to say it never got as close to me as this seemed to have gotten to you.
Right. You know, we were only about 6 miles or so from the fire itself, and we came home from being in town in Anchorage that Sunday afternoon. We rushed home as quick as we could, and we sort of sat around and thought about what we should do. Since we weren't too close, we figured we better be ready to go just in case. And it was about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. We had 5 people here, 5 trucks, and we packed up and moved out, along with all of our neighbors, Vern Halter and several other mushers here in our community. We got out of here as fast as we could. But if we could jump just quickly over to a really big hub of mushing in Didi Genro's neighborhood, there's sort of kind of a community over there of mushers, including her and Jamie and Justin High, Jan Steves and Bob Klupach, and also Peter Duncan. He's not an Iditarod musher, but he's also in that same neighborhood. And all of their homes burned down. And I'm sure you've heard the stories, Alex, about Didi and what she was doing. She was over at Martin Booser's place, which is in Big Lake, about 45 minutes or so south of here. And she was giving a talk with Martin to a group of tourists. and somebody gave her a call and said, you got to get home as quickly as you can. There's a fire burning real quick. And she got home just in time to get her dogs out and a few possessions. And within minutes, her home had burned down along with just about everybody in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and, you know, as people may not know, fire is a very strange thing, and it acts often unpredictably. And there were some initial reports on Sunday and Monday that it was believed that several people's homes had burned, and it turned out that some of the homes that they thought had burned had actually survived. And sometimes fire, as it's going along, will jump over and skip over one building or another building, and it is very, very hard to predict.
Right.
Having said that, there were, I believe I read this morning, there were somewhere around 50 homes that were lost and another 50 structures that were not homes. This has been an enormous toll on the Mushing community. And before we get into that a little bit more deeply, I want to say that as someone looking at this from outside, obviously this is a horrible event and very tragic for Dee Dee and for Jan Steves and everybody else who lost property. But looking at how this unfolded, I was struck by the closeness of the community and how people all banded together to protect each other and protect the dogs and make sure that there was, that loss of property was minimized and loss of life was prevented in almost every case. And there were, you know, Martin Boozer opened his kennel to anybody who needed to bring their dogs there. Scott Jansen, the Mushing mortician, opened his parking lot and area to anyone who needed a place to take their dogs. And then he announced on Facebook that he was going to be going up and down the highway with his dog truck, and anyone who needed help bringing their dogs out, he was available to them. And there was such an amazing outpouring of community spirit that it was wonderful to watch from afar.
You know, it is amazing. All of these people, we know each other, but we don't. You know, we know each other from the trails. We know each other from get-togethers. But I was just totally amazed about how everybody came together. And I've never been a part of anything like this before. I've never had to evacuate my home and never had anybody having to come over and check on us to see if we're okay. And it was just amazing act of community spirit, as you mentioned. And one in particular, nation and worldwide support. I know that a lady by the name of Connie Starr, who is part of the Northwest Sled Dog Association, she started a GoFundMe page or one of those crowdsourcing pages to raise money for the mushers to help rebuild, and that's earned multiple thousands of dollars for these folks. I know that they're doing an auction over in the UK somewhere where people are bidding on Iditarod and other mushing memorabilia, and that's going like crazy. And there's just people all over the country and all over this little community of about 2,000 people who are really pulling together for the mushers that have been affected. And remember, Alex, these aren't just Iditarod mushers. There are several mushers that nobody's ever heard of, but they're still banding together to help everybody out. And I think that's an amazing story in of itself.
Yeah, and I had written it down, but I can't locate it right now. There was a dog food company that announced that they were donating dog food to any mushers who had evacuated and just needed food. Martin Boozer had announced, in addition to the GoFundMe thing you mentioned, that anyone who wanted to make donations directly to a musher could send the donations to the musher care of Martin at the Happy Trails Kennel, and he would make sure that they got it. And as you said, there's been an enormous outpouring of support for people in a very, very difficult time.
And our club here, the Willow Dog Mushers Association, is the one that is handling all of these donations, and they plan to dole that out to all of the mushers. And it's interesting with that two of our board members lost their homes in that fire. Peter Duncan, who we mentioned, who is the treasurer, and Justin and Jamie High, he is the vice president. So they're still working tirelessly, not only to get everything together to rebuild their homes, but also making sure that the others are taken care of as well. And they just announced yesterday that any other musher that is affected by these wildfires, they're going to divvy up this money through these donations equally amongst all of them. And I know up a little bit further north, we're going to talk about some of these checkpoints here in a minute. Brent Sass's place is kind of in the line of fire right now, and he's evacuated all of his dogs. And what's interesting up there is they don't have the communication abilities that we have down here. Satellite links and internet and cell phones don't work as well, of course, up there, and we've talked about that a lot. But can you imagine how frightening it would be if you're up there and you have no lines of communication at all, and you are in the bush, so to speak, and you have 50, 60, 70 dogs that you've got to get out in a hurry?
Absolutely. And, you know, in addition to everything else, well, first I want to briefly mention there, for anyone who is in or around Anchorage tomorrow, June 25th, there's going to be a fundraiser at the Lakefront Hotel, which used to be the Millennium. I guess they changed the name recently. So they're going to have a fundraising event, which is free, but they're going to be raising money. I think they're going to be auctioning things and other stuff there to support all of the mushers who were impacted by this fire. Also, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our friend Helen Hegener, who has been tirelessly for the past week and a half coordinating people who have needs with people who have the ability to help, and has been, you know, among many, many other things, has arranged for belongings that were able to be saved, to be put into storage while people are rebuilding, was just all day and all night, Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, was coordinating who was where and trying to figure out, you know, for people who needed space to take dogs or needed space for themselves or their family, where they could go. So this has been like a big community, a big show of community support, and it is hundreds and probably thousands of people have done lots of little things, but it all adds up to something really huge that I have to say partially restores my shaken faith in humanity.
You know, me too. And you know what, Alex, not to minimize this on any person at all when they have to evacuate due to a natural disaster, whether it be fire, earthquake, hurricane, or whatever, but when it's just one person and or a family that has to pack up the Subaru and evacuate to a shelter or to a different place, it's an entirely different ordeal altogether when you have 40, 50, 60, maybe 70 dogs that you got to make sure that you can move down the line quickly and efficiently as well. So I think that not only did everybody do it very quickly and very orderly, but everybody did it in a timely fashion where, you know, it was almost like a well-oiled machine. Everybody knew what they were supposed to do and got down the line as quickly as they possibly could. And I mentioned this on our Facebook page just recently. Here in the Mat-Su Valley, they are requiring us to have evacuation plans that not only are approved by the Mat-Su Borough, but they have to be in place and ready to go at a moment's notice. And everybody that has been inspected, I guess, by the animal control to get our kennel license, all of us had to have those. And those pieces of paper were invaluable. We knew what we needed to grab, where we needed to grab it, where we're going to take our dogs, who we needed to call, all within with no reservation. We knew exactly what we were supposed to do. So I think that that's a good thing, and I'm glad that that is now required for all kennels, at least up here in Alaska.
Yeah, it certainly helped, and what also must have helped is the fact that mushers are used to being able to go into a checkpoint, deal with the dogs, take care of the dogs. So I would think that that ability to focus on the dogs and the needs of the dogs would help get things ready for evacuation in a relatively short period of time.
Right. So, Alex, we're going to put some links on our show page here this evening of where folks can go to learn more about this. And as I mentioned, some of the links for folks that can donate if they want or bid on items that is going on for at least the rest of the week, and make sure that we can do our best to be a part of this this message that we're trying to get across. Do you have anything else on the fires before we jump into our topic today?
Yeah, just wanted to mention that once the fire is fully contained or is out, that's really not the end of this. For people who've lost their homes, this is going to be something that will go on for many, many months. And so if people have the ability, I would definitely encourage them to do something to help, because there is going to be a lot of need for a long time.
Exactly right. So, Alex, today we're going to jump back into our checkpoints. We talked about the southern route in our last few episodes, and today we're going to talk about the several checkpoints that are along the northern route, and we're only going to talk about the ones that are not part of the normal southern route. So let's jump into those. We have about 12 minutes or so. Alex, what is the first one on our list?
Okay, so the northern and southern routes divide after Ophir, and from Ophir, the first checkpoint on the northern route is Cripple, and that is on the northern years. That's the official halfway point. It's a fairly long stretch. It's a 73-mile run from Ophir to Cripple, and Cripple is one of the checkpoints where there is a population of zero. So there is nobody who lives full-time in Cripple. It's a very, very long stretch from Ophir, a lot of little hills. There was a forest fire there in 1997 that burned about 1 million acres,
wow.
Which, you know, is anywhere outside of Alaska, that's an impossibly large area to think of being hit by fire. But it burned about 1 million acres. Unlike the Farewell Burn, where most of the trees that burned or died were totally destroyed, a lot of the trees along this area were left standing. So you have a long stretch where there are some new trees that have been growing in the last 20 years or so, but also a lot of trees that are just standing but not alive.
Right.
So that is considered a very difficult leg, just because there are very few landmarks. So you're going through an area where everything kind of looks the same, and people have reported that it gets very difficult to tell exactly how much progress you've made and how far you have to go.
Just real quick, Alex, to let folks know that are listening, you can go to iditarod.com and look at all of these checkpoints and the mileage, and they've got great information of descriptions about how far they are, and even some of them have picture and video, and I'm looking at it right now. It says from Ophir to Cripple, 73 miles. It takes approximately 12 to 18 hours. That's still cooking pretty good on a dog team. In particular, if the weather is bad, it could take much longer. But 73 miles is a decent amount of mileage to go on a checkpoint. And as we talked about on the southern route, any of these checkpoints here in the deep interior, there's not a whole lot going on. As you said, Alex, it's just pretty much you and your dog team and working your way through the miles.
Right. And in this middle part of the race, the distances between checkpoints tend to be greater. Early in the race, we saw, you know, some checkpoints are 20 or 30 miles away from other checkpoints. So now we're getting to 70 miles, 73 miles between checkpoints. That's a fairly long stretch. And, you know, as we've talked about many times, this is also where your strategy and how you approach your run-rest cycle with your dogs can really start to come into play and make huge differences between the teams that are doing really well and the teams that are falling behind.
So our next checkpoint is from Cripple to Ruby at 70 miles. And can you correct me if I'm wrong here, but this was about the connection point of this year's race. Is that right, Alex?
I believe so, yes. And Ruby is a fairly famous place in mushing circles. It's the home of Emmett Peters, who won the third race in 1975. George Albert, who is a who makes custom snowshoes that many mushers use, lives in Ruby. It's also the first checkpoint on the Yukon River. So in the past, there has been a for the first musher to get there, they win a multi-course gourmet dinner prepared by the chefs at the Millennium, I guess now the Lakefront Hotel, over a camp stove. So that's always been one of these fascinating little things about the Iditarod that you don't find in many sporting events.
Right. So our next checkpoint, Alex, is Ruby to Galena, 50 miles. What is happening at that little place?
So this is a fairly straightforward leg of the race. You're mostly right on the Yukon River, which is a very, very wide river at this point. It's about a mile wide at Ruby, and it between Ruby and Galena, it stretches out to where it's more than 2 miles across. Even in the coldest years, because the river is so large, there's almost always areas of open water. So it can be a little bit of a difficult stretch. You have to be very careful for open water or, you know, ice on the river. And at times it can get very windy in this stretch as well. So if there is a wind coming at you, that can also make this relatively hard going.
So our next checkpoint is Galena to Nualto. That is 37 miles, and that's also in the news today, in particular with these forest fires. Have you heard that story?
I haven't. I haven't. I heard about Brent up in, I think, Eureka. I heard about that fire, but I also read that there are right now over 200 wildfires burning in Alaska. So, it's going to be a rough fire season up there, I think.
Well, I read on the news last night, the 10 o'clock news, the entire village of Nualto has been evacuated downriver to Caltag. And that's no easy feat because the only way in or out at this point is by boat on the Yukon. And they've taken out all of the elders as well as all of the women and children to do their best to get everybody evacuated downriver. And we talked a second ago about folks like Brent Sass up there that don't have the amenities, I guess, that we do here on the road system with the communications and whatnot. Can you imagine trying to move an entire community by boat down the Yukon River?
Yes, that must be a very difficult thing. And, you know, we talk about the efficiency at which people in your neck of the woods were able to evacuate. And this is people who, you know, have dog trucks, they have vehicles, they can take whatever they can fit in their vehicle. If you're getting an entire village and I think we're talking about 500 or 600 people there to evacuate on boats, I would imagine that they would not be able to take very many belongings with them.
As well as getting all that firefighting equipment in there, whatever they need to do to get there in these types of places. And just like anywhere else out in the bush or in the mountains in California or wherever, I can imagine that's a daunting task to try to get firefighting crews and hoses and all of that equipment that are required to fight fires where there are no roads or there's no easy way in or out.
Absolutely. And fortunately, a lot of the firefighters who are working in Alaska, including crews from a bunch of different states in the lower 48, are extremely well trained and are able to go in and just do minor miracles. And, I think we are all very, very thankful for all of the first responders, but especially right now for the firefighters.
So our next checkpoint is Nualto to Caltag, 47 miles. We have two more checkpoints here to talk about today. What's happening in Caltag? That's also on the Yukon River.
Right. So this is a major run down the Yukon. It's fairly straight. You go past several islands. At one point on the right bank, there are ridges that are over 1,000 feet, but it's pretty much a straight shot. Caltag is a relatively large village compared to some of the previous ones. It's got over 600 people, and I read this morning that there are three different stores in Caltag, and in a lot of these villages there will be one general store, and that is pretty much it. So, if you can think of a community of 600 or 700 people as being a major community, this is a relatively major community in this part of the race.
So any perspective there, Alex, how far can you stretch to find 600 people where you live? Maybe an eighth of a mile?
You know, there's probably 600 people on my block.
Wow.
I went to a meeting here once, a community policing meeting, and they mentioned that the major intersection that's about a quarter of a mile away from me, there are 180,000 cars that go by that intersection every day.
Holy cow. So definitely some perspective there, a checkpoint in the middle of nowhere in the bush of Alaska that has 600 people, and which they just doubled, I guess, in size if they got all those folks from Nualto on the boats from the fires compared to the number of folks that are pretty much within shouting distance of your front porch. That's amazing when you think about the size of Alaska.
Absolutely. And that's the reason why a lot of people like to live in Alaska. They don't want to be around 180,000 people. They want to be in a much smaller community. And even within Alaska, you always have people who refer to Los Anchorage and how they don't want to, that places like Willow are too crowded for them and they want to be out where there's not a lot of people.
So our last checkpoint, and we've talked about this run before, but I guess what I wanted to do is go from one place to the next major checkpoint, which is Unalakleet. We've talked about that before, but how is that trail from Caltag to Unalakleet, and how far is it?
It's a little over 80 miles, 82 miles, and this is the big portage between the Yukon and the Bering Coast. So a lot of times people will camp along the way. There are a couple of cabins that many teams stop at. The Tripod Flats cabin is about 35 miles from Caltag. There's a cabin called the Old Woman Cabin that's about 50 miles from Caltag. And those are maintained by the Bureau of Land Management, so they're fairly... there are still cabins, but they're fairly well kept up. And this is, this part of the trail is an area where a number of teams have had trouble in the past 3 or 4 years. So it is not an easy stretch of trail. I believe that there can be some fairly severe storms and wind that you have to face here. Jeff King's team was stopped on this part of the trail a couple years ago. So this is really a difficult transition from being on the Yukon, which is relatively straightforward, to being on the Bering Coast, which is also challenging but relatively straightforward.
And we've talked about it several times on our talks about these checkpoints. Here at Unalakleet, it's still approximately 261 miles from Nome, and this is what we often talk about in the race of thirds. This is the last third of the race, and as you mentioned, it takes you across the sea ice and into the last mandatory checkpoint there at White Mountain, and then, of course, on into Nome. So a lot of strategy is developed here at this checkpoint, and as we mentioned, a lot of sleds are traded out. A lot of times they'll go to a much smaller and faster sled, and, of course, a lot of dogs are dropped. And even a lot of spectators are in Unalakleet because it's a pretty major port for airplanes to come in and out. So there's still quite a bit of fanfare at this spot compared to some of those more desolate places along the trail that we just mentioned.
Absolutely. And in Unalakleet, there is you can fly in and out on commercial airlines. So that makes it much easier to get to. On some of these other checkpoints in the middle of the race, the only way to get there is by a small plane or by chartering a plane or by going with a tour company. And so that makes it much more difficult to get to. So a place like Unalakleet is more of a hub, and they tend to gather the drop dogs from around there in Unalakleet and then fly them usually back to Anchorage from there.
So, Alex, we are out of time, but I want to mention one other thing. During Iditarod, you had mentioned that you're coming up to Alaska this summer to do some speaking engagements. Is that still the plan?
It's actually, unfortunately, not still the plan. I was going to be up in Alaska in early July, but now that got moved, unfortunately.
Hey, that's okay. You're always welcome here. I'm definitely interested to have you come up this way and buy you dinner anytime you're out and about. So what is happening over the next couple of months? I know you and I are going to continue this show through the off-season. What's happening in your world in the off-season of Iditarod?
Well, I'm making plans because I really am going to try this year to come up and follow the back of the pack in Iditarod. So I'm doing a lot of groundwork to try to make that happen in 2016. I have to say that I've said this to you privately, but let me say it again to you on the air. I think we are all very, very thankful and grateful that you and your family are okay, and that your dogs are okay, and that your property survived with no damage or relatively minor damage from the fire.
Well, thank you very much for that, Alex, and I'm sure that everybody that was affected definitely feels the same way, and they appreciate those kind words. One last thing, Alex, I know we're recording, but this Saturday is the Mushers sign-up and volunteer picnic that happens here at Iditarod headquarters. Have you ever been a part of that?
I have not, and I was really hoping to come up this summer, so I'm not going to make it this year, but I do pledge that I will be up for the picnic one of these years.
It will be interesting to see how that works out with so many of these guys affected, and some of them may not know what's coming up in the very near future, as we mentioned, folks, to the north of us with these fires. So I think it's going to be sort of a celebratory picnic, but also a little bit somber as well, because a lot of folks' lives really changed in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that will happen is I anticipate there will be another huge outpouring of support from the fans to a lot of the mushers who have been affected by this fire. And, you know, when you Dee Dee Janro has always been a fan favorite and is considered one of the most popular mushers who has never actually won the Iditarod. So the fact that her home was lost, I think, is going to have a huge effect on the fans. And I would not be surprised if there were some additional kind of fundraising thing that was started at the picnic.
Alex, do you have one more minute? I wanted to bring up one other topic. Do you have a second?
Oh, of course.
You know, I just thought of this. I remember seeing the pictures during the fire of the folks that were finding their belt buckles. Did you see that story about, I believe it was Bob Klupach, and I believe one other
yes.
one had found their belt buckles in the fire, and that's just an amazing story. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I didn't see the other one, but I saw Bob's, and it was partially burned. It was a little bit smoky. I think it was part of the writing had become a little bit hard to read. But, you know, as someone who loves the Iditarod, I can't help but see that as a symbol that, you know, you can face adversity, you can have things, material things destroyed, but people will find a way to persevere.
I believe he got his when he ran the race in 1977. And remember, you only get one of those belt buckles. I'm sure Iditarod would replace it in this instance, but you only get one. That is a keepsake that very few people have. And I can just imagine finding that in all of that rubble. Because he was awful elated when he found that and he put it on Facebook. And he had quite a sense of humor about that as well.
Right, and as you mentioned, you get one of the, no matter how many times you finish Iditarod, you get one belt buckle. So if you finish 37 times, you get a belt buckle the same as someone who's only run the race once and finished it.
Such amazing stories in this time of troubling times here up in Willow, as well as other places here in Alaska. So, Alex, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for being on with me today, and we'll see you guys in a couple of weeks, okay?
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.